And welcome to It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics in practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network, or NSHEN. I'm Andrea Frolick, the interim network ethicist for NSHEN, and I'll be your host for this discussion. I am super excited to welcome a special guest who's joining me today from Ottawa, Ontario. Dr. James Downer is a critical care and palliative care physician in Ottawa. He's currently professor and head of the Division of Palliative Care at the University of Ottawa, where he holds a clinical research chair in palliative and end-of-life care. Welcome, James.
Good morning.
So, James, we have you here today to talk a little bit about the research you've been doing into psychedelics, and specifically psychedelics in the context of palliative end-of-life care, and reflecting on the research ethics dimensions of psychedelic research and the need for exceptions to our usual regulatory and scientific approach. So I'm hoping you can start us off with some context. James, why are you interested in research on psychedelic medication?
Yeah, so a great question. And I mean, I think the context is really everything for this discussion, right? So I think many of your listeners will be familiar with some of the recent studies and some of the buzz around psychedelic medications and the potential that they hold. So what is a psychedelic medication? Psychedelic medications are medications that induce a psychedelic experience. Many of them fit, they're known as a serotonin 2A receptor agonists, technically, if you want to know. And what happens when you take a large dose of one of these substances, it induces a state where, for example, you get perceptual abnormalities, like your senses merge into each other, you can get hallucinations, but often people have this very mystical experience where they sort of become one with the universe, or the boundary between what is them and what is not them sort of dissipates. You do this with the assistance, guidance of a therapist. After some weeks of preparation, you might do more than one session with this. And at the end of it, many people describe a remarkable improvement in, for example, long-standing psychological distress, depression, anxiety, all sorts of different problems seem to get better when you do this. Now, there's been a lot of buzz about this for many years. Back in the 50s and 60s, some early research was very promising, but then it got caught up in the war on drugs and regulations more or less shut it down for decades. But there's been a resuscitation of interest in this in the past 10, 15 years, and a number of really exciting early studies showing that, again, remarkable improvements in people's level of distress, even though they've been perhaps refractory to many other medications and very chronic symptoms, people describing these mystical experiences. So there's a lot of excitement. These substances are actually illegal in most places, but not hard to obtain, so many people are able to sort of use them without necessarily involving physicians or psychologists' help. And so there's been a lot of excitement about it. But there are a number of important considerations when you are using it. So this becomes quite a challenge, right? So you've got mental illness, which is one of the most common, burdensome, debilitating conditions in humanity. It is arguably responsible for the greatest loss of work years of life of any condition that we know. The other problem, of course, is that when you look at psychiatric treatments, many of them have substantial limitations, that they're either very resource heavy in the form of interpersonal psychotherapy, or perhaps that the effectiveness of the medication is sometimes limited. So there are certainly people that respond very well, but there are a very large number of people that don't. And so you have a very common problem, not a lot of great solutions right now, and sort of temperatures getting turned up on this. In Canada, we have also the additional concern that within a couple of years, assisted dying it may be a legal option for people with mental illness as a sole underlying condition. And so you have this sort of mix where there's a lot of pressure, a lot of demand to find new solutions to this problem outside of our existing paradigm. So that's in palliative care, which is what I do, we are focused heavily on existential distress, right, which is a particular type of psychological distress where people sort of related to their illness essentially is robbing them of their ability to do things that they normally would have done, things that they find meaningful and enjoyable. And so as a result of this, people feel tremendous distress. It changes their relationship with their families and the people around them. And it causes an assault on their person, really, this great distress, which is, in fact, the number one reason why people are requesting medical assistance in dying. And there's been a lot of research into, palliative care consultations, medications really don't seem to be all that effective for it routinely. And even, very focused therapies focused on existential distress for people with advanced illness show very modest effectiveness, that the impact of the therapy is not large, and it's not particularly long-standing, it's not particularly durable. And there are many people, of course, that don't want to receive a psychotherapy, and psychotherapy is not broadly available to everybody. So, you have, again, a problem where this is possibly one of the most burdensome problems for people with advanced illness, and we have very limited options. So there's a lot of interest in finding newer approaches to try to treat this, and psilocybin seems to be one of those approaches.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So there are psychedelics for mental illness overall, and then there's this subset of that population, which is the population you are interested in researching and that you treat as a palliative care clinician, which is folk who are experiencing existential distress at end of life. And the question you've been reflecting on with your team is, could psychedelic medication make a difference in that population that often doesn't respond to conventional mental illness interventions, mental health interventions?
That's right.
So I'm wondering if you can just level set for all of us, because many of us who would be listening are not familiar with the current regulatory framework in Canada, either for clinical use or research in terms of the use of psychedelics. So could you provide us with a bit of an overview of the current regulatory framework for psychedelic research in our country, so we understand the context of this conversation and how you're engaging with that regulatory framework in the research you're doing now?
Yeah, so psychedelic medications are kind of a special category of medications. And the one that we talk about most commonly is psilocybin, which is just derived from the psilocybin mushroom, magic mushroom, some people would know them as. So psilocybin is actually what's called a restricted substance in Canada, which puts it above things like opioids and other medications that are controlled. So when you want to do research on a restricted substance, the rules are quite complicated. So normally, if I wanted to do a research study on a drug that was, for example, not restricted but just not approved for use, for a certain condition, I would need to construct the study, construct a trial. I have to get a what's called a no objection letter from Health Canada to get this thing going. It has to go through the REB. I have to get funding, obviously, and get a source for the medication. And then I would try to enroll a bunch of patients. They would be at various different sites. They would go to get the medication or a placebo, often, which is your comparator or some other standard of care that you're comparing this new medication to. You randomize all the people you enroll in the trial. So half of them get the new drug, half of them get either a placebo or the old drug or the standard of care, and then off you go. And you study the outcomes and see if this medication is as good as or better than what is the current standard. And it's using that paradigm that we try to approach all trials. But for restricted substances, it's much more complicated. So the substance itself, there are very few suppliers, and each supplier has to have a special, like, lot of testing done on their product to make sure to satisfy Health Canada that they have what they say they have. Getting that process done, getting that sort of dossier is quite a lengthy process, and many suppliers don't actually have one yet. When you get the substance as well, you have to have a license to possess it because it's illegal. So the license doesn't extend to, for example, pharmacists, nurses, etc. It extends to James Downer and possibly one other person involved in the study. When I store the medication, I have to construct essentially a fortress in my office. So my office now has a gun safe bolted to the floor, not the wall. I have to have a thickness of 10 centimeters of brick around my office. My window is supposed to have a grill on it. In fact, it's a bulletproof window. And I have a solid metal door. It's got an alarm with a siren on it that makes me really popular with my neighbors. There's $10,000 worth of security put into just my office to protect what is a medication that has a street value of about $45. And just the punchline of that, of course, is that a block and a half from my hospital, there's one of these dispensaries that just sells it openly. Now, that dispensary is been raided a few times, so they shut down. But you know, the company that owns it will mail it to you, and they've got a website, and no one's attempting to shut them down. So there's a tremendous number, like the burden, the barrier to entry for a study like this is quite complicated. Getting all these various licenses, getting the different approvals that you need. So we just completed doing a study of what's called microdosing psilocybin. I'll talk about that in a second. But we obtained funding for this in January of 2020. And it took us 4 years before we got all the approvals to enroll our first patient in January 2024. And it only took us, 14 months to do the study. So that gives you some idea about how much work actually is involved in getting some of these studies off the ground. It's a tremendous amount of regulatory burden there. There's some other conceptual problems with using psilocybin and doing these types of trials, which is, and this came up in the U.S. recently where they were looking at MDMA for PTSD, people with PTSD. And what happens, of course, when you do a controlled trial, if you're giving somebody, for example, the drug and you're giving someone else a placebo, they're not supposed to be able to know which group they're in because there could be a placebo effect or what's called an expectation effect where you sort of psychologically talk yourself into getting a good response when in fact it had nothing to do with that. It was just that you knew what group you were in. And of course, because psilocybin is a psychedelic, right, it produces this sort of transcendental experience that lasts for several hours. It's basically impossible for somebody not to know what group they're in, no matter how good a job you do blinding them, so to speak, to the pill that you're giving them. Like, they're gonna know when they have the psychedelic experience that they've received a medication, and when they don't have that psychedelic experience, they may experience other sort of bizarre effects that they've sort of psychologically talked themselves into receiving. But I think on the whole, most people will tend to know which group they were in. So this is known as functional unblinding. And the FDA in the U.S. actually failed to approve, rejected the application for MDMA on the basis partially that there was functional unblinding. So it's a real problem with the classic sort of macro dosing studies that have been done to date, and remains a challenge for anyone doing research in this area.
Right. And this is part of what they talk about in the ethics literature around the, quote, psychedelic exceptionalism in terms of research methodology and research ethics. So can you tell me how your research on microdosing gets around this, or just simply recognizes and accommodates the reality that blinding isn't possible in a macro-dosing environment?
Yeah, so the study that we did in microdosing, and I think many of your listeners may be familiar with the difference between macro and microdosing, but in brief, macrodosing is where you do essentially a program of psychotherapy, and in the middle of it, you have one or more sessions where there's a sort of six-hour session where you are having a psychedelic experience, and the psychotherapy is structured around that, integrating this. And it's the core of this is this one experience or two experiences that your benefits are linked to. It is essentially psychotherapy with an sort of augmentation in the middle. Microdosing psilocybin is quite different. So this is where people have been reporting doing this for years, where you take about 5 to 10% of a psychedelic dose, but you don't take it just once. You take it kind of multiple days in the week. So 2 to 4 times a week is sort of standard. And people report that they just feel really good all the time. Like, they feel like they're having a really good day. And, they're just feeling positive. They seem to describe getting a lot of the benefits of psychedelic medication, but without ever having a psychedelic experience. They don't get the perceptual abnormalities. And most of them, the joke is they eat, a couple of, like a slice or two of mushrooms, and then hop behind the wheel of a Maserati, and then they go off and run a Fortune 500 company. This is sort of the California standard these days. So what's interesting, of course, then, is that if you're not getting the psychedelic experience, then functional unblinding is no longer as big of an issue. People can still sometimes get side effects, and in every study this happens. And a substantial proportion of people in a study can generally figure out which group they're in simply by side effects or other effects of the medication. One of the things we do in studies is ask people, do they know what group they're in? Quite commonly they figure it out. So this is very, the advantage of microdosing is, there's quite a few advantages actually. So one of them is, of course, the methodological one you're alluding to, which is that you don't get functional unblinding as a problem. But you also get a tremendous benefit of potentially scalability if it works, right? So again, leaving aside the question of whether it is as effective as macrodosing or the effectiveness in general, because I mean, we've completed our study, the results were very, very impressive. But again, it was not placebo-controlled, so it could well have all been placebo. We won't know until we do the randomized control trial, which we are submitting all the paperwork for now. But the issue, again, with macro dosing is that you still need the psychotherapy. You still need to be able to access a therapist. You know, there are logistical challenges. For somebody with advanced illness, it's quite a stress on the body to get a very strong serotonergic, so the medication causes a serotonergic surge, and you get like your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure can go up, you get nausea, people throw up, and so there are certainly a number of people that, you know, you might look at a frailer person and say, I don't know if I really want to do that to this person. Could this person tolerate it? And there may be, you know, people where what's commonly referred to as ego strength. So people you're worried that if they lose control, that they might actually have a very negative experience. And there are people who have had PTSD from psychedelic experiences. So having a medication where you don't need to arrange psychotherapy, you can literally start it on day one. You don't get the strong these same level of serotonergic effects that can be quite stressful, and you don't worry about the potential backfiring of a psychedelic experience. Here's a great option, right? Cost, scalability. A lot of this, sort of gets a lot easier. So that's one of the reasons why we were really keen to look at it, particularly for palliative care, because we think it might be able to offer something different in this sphere. And I don't think it's competing necessarily with macrodosing, microdosing. They're fundamentally different approaches to using a medication that just happens to be the same.
Right. So what I'm hearing is that the microdosing allows the opportunity even to conduct an RCT because you don't have this functional unblinding. And so I'm curious about your motivation for pursuing this research in the population that you've chosen, which is palliative care or people who are at end of life. Why that population specifically, since many people struggle with mental illness at various stages of the life course? And do you feel like there's a particular moral imperative for us to make psychedelic medications more accessible to this population?
Yeah, so that's where a lot of this gets engaged. I mean, you know, there's sort of, right now, and this is true, I think, all over the world, in many jurisdictions, not just Canada. But of course, in Canada, we know that psychological distress, existential distress, is probably the most common form of distress that people experience as they approach the end of life. So very much more so than pain or other symptoms. And many patients describe it as the most burdensome symptom that they have, far worse than the physical pain or shortness of breath. So as many as 30 to 40% of people get this and can be quite severe. And of course, Canada has legalized MAID, right? Assisted dying. So, you know, this is the option. Again, only it's about 4 or 5% of the Canadian population actually use assisted dying. The vast majority don't. So the vast majority of people, even with severe existential psychological distress, don't take MAID as their, don't use MAID as the option. But it is the option there. And I think that when you have an option like MAID on the table clinically, it becomes very important to, I think that has to change the way you view risk, right? You have to contextualize all aspects of risk when you live in an environment where someone can opt to take a legal means to end their life. And so, you know, you have assisted dying as the option that someone can take, and then you're trying to do a study of psilocybin, and someone says, well, you know, I don't know, this might just be placebo, or oh, I'm a little worried about the, you know, do we really know the risks of addiction for psilocybin long term? Which was another concern cited by the FDA, was, oh, we can't approve this because we don't know about the long term addiction effects. And, you know, when you work in palliative care, you're like, okay, yeah, like I get it. Like, you know, that's definitely a concern, it's a risk. But, you know, if all you do is look unidimensionally at the risk of a change, a potential new thing, you're not really going to get anywhere here. You can't just sort of say this is a risk compared to zero risk, you know, because remember that we're treating one of the most serious problems that people experience as they get close to death. It is bad enough, this suffering is bad enough that people want to end their life. You know, maybe if you could exchange that problem for a small risk of addiction, who wouldn't make that trade? So, you know, the concerns are there, and I don't think they should be dismissed entirely. We need to study them. We need to understand them. But in the context of a theoretical risk where MAID is on the table, I think you have to start to say, look, okay, it's really hard to do research on macrodosing. You know, yes, there is this concern about functional unblinding, but it's very hard to control for that. And you know, where you have certain types of medication where, you know, you're asking for all these types of security and safety things around this, that you've got regulations that the nurses and the pharmacists can't touch it, meaning that it becomes very challenging to do research in this area, and you're worried about what the risk of somebody might steal the medication, you know, that's freely available to somebody to order online, right? And you're worried they're going to steal, you know, $2 worth of stuff, to the point that now people have to construct a $10,000 fortress in their office. It seems a bit ridiculous. Like I feel like the framing of risk and of this type of medication and of this type of research, I feel like the risks are being hyper magnified to a degree that is, I would say, almost absurd when compared to the impact of the thing you're trying to treat. So to my mind, from an ethical standpoint, as we start to talk to REBs about getting these studies approved and done, as we talk to regulators in Health Canada about getting approvals for these studies and all the sort of various different security things that we have to put in place for the studies, I think we need to start to say, guys, can we take a step back here and say that this is actually, the moral imperative here is really high to get moving on some research and to find alternative treatments for a thing for which we have very, very little to offer. This is not an argument against all regulation, and I certainly am not blaming the clinical trials individuals at Health Canada. They've been extremely helpful in trying to facilitate this research. But I think that, you know, they're applying rules that they've been handed. You know, and I think we maybe as a nation, and in terms of the people in charge of regulation, could take a really hard look at this and say maybe we can, for certain types of things, as we approach end of life, in contexts where these are, yes, controlled substances, but controlled substances that are frankly very easy to get, not particularly expensive, and not extremely risky as far as we can tell, maybe we can back off a little bit. I wouldn't say the same thing about, you know, all controlled, restricted, or illegal substances. I think there are actually, you can do a lot of harm with many of these, but I would not necessarily put psilocybin in that same category, particularly if you're able to control the amount of the substance involved. So, mm-hmm. You know, the ethical imperative here is really one where we have to say, it's not an argument against all rules and get rid of all the rules, quite the contrary. Keep the rules. The rules are good and they're there for a reason. But let's start to look at certain things like psychedelics. Let's think about an argument for exceptionalism here, given the problem you're trying to fix, the substance that's involved, and the legal environment that we live in, and start to say, maybe we could be a little more risk tolerant when it comes to clinical use and studies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, James. I really appreciated you walking us through the current regulatory environment, the challenges in from a research methodology perspective, as well as a implementation of research perspective, and helping us understand your perspective on why there should be a moral argument for making psilocybin access, specifically in the end-of-life population, more of a, let's say, a public policy imperative, because there are so few alternatives that are appropriate and available and effective for that population. And I'm imagining that as we face the prospect of MAID becoming available for persons who have a mental disorder as the sole underlying medical condition, that imperative for exceptionalism in terms of access to this range of medications might even grow or become a greater and greater imperative. So I really appreciate you sharing your expertise and your research experience to date. I want to end with one last question. which is, what is the one thing that you wish ethicists or ethics committee members in Canada to understand about psychedelic medication or psychedelic research?
Yeah, I think it's hard to narrow it down to just one thing. I'll have a couple of snippets maybe I can leave you with. One of them is, you know, just obviously I think this is very exciting, but we need to maintain objectivity and caution and apply scientific rigor to what we do. We don't want to throw everything out with this. But I do think that, you know, for anyone involved in research ethics or other activities involved, if you're ever asked to review a study, to please remember to contextualize the risk for the type of problems that you see treated here. You know, this is not, you know, we're not trying to sort of treat a trivial, superficial cosmetic problem here for which there are tons of alternatives. This is a big problem and we don't have much for it. So please be kind to your researchers and understand that.
Great. Thank you so much, James, for sharing your experience, your expertise, and your reflections on psychedelic research in our Canadian context.
Thank you so much, Andrea, for having me on.
And that's another episode of It's Complicated, a podcast about healthcare ethics and practice presented by the Nova Scotia Health Ethics Network. And we continue to be grateful for the production support from Lisbeth Nielsen, Krista Mlenko-Scarry, and the team at Dalhousie MedIT. And thanks to Ben Capps for our theme music, and most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. Until next time.